Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I have a great guest today. And you know, I tell you people how I get guests. You know, some people are old friends and some people are just, he's a very big name in the industry. And I was sitting there and we're friends on Facebook. And if you don't know people, most comics or comedians are, they become friends on Facebook, even though they don't know each other, because we have like 180 or 300 mutual friends. So we always send them a request, and they usually say yes. I mean, most times I'm not going to say no when you know a lot of people. And he has a friend of mine, and then I know his name from the TV shows he's worked on. He's worked on Everyone Loves Raymond, Hot in Cleveland, Till Death, and Seinfeld. And that was the thing. I'm a big Seinfeld fan, and I didn't see a lot of Seinfelds. I always thought I watched it a lot, but when it was on, I was doing comedy on the road a lot, so I didn't have Thursdays free, and I was married to a woman who couldn't use a VCR, so I always missed the shows. And this girl I'm friends with is a big Seinfeld fan, so we've been talking. And a few weeks ago, I sat there, and I was watching an episode, and in the credits, I saw Steve. His name's Steve Skorvin. Welcome, Steve.
Hi.
His name's Steve Skorvin. And I saw his name, and I said, you know what? We're friends on Facebook. Well, why don't I give it a try? Because you never know. And then I remember, because you emailed me back, and you're like, how'd you find me?
Yeah.
Because we don't know who. I don't know. I mean, I see like posts from people on Facebook. I don't even know who they are.
Right.
I'm like, I'm friends with this person? Or someone will say, thanks for the ad. I'm like, because if I get an ad, I confirm it. Like, I have people listen on the radio show. I'm like, how does this person like Chili know me? And I'm like, oh, they must listen to the show. So Steve's on, and now welcome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Steve.
So you're writing now, but now you started off doing comedy, right? Now where are you from?
I'm from Cleveland, Ohio originally.
Okay. Now, did you start off in Cleveland?
I started off, my first 6 months of comedy was in Cleveland at the Cleveland Comedy Club.
Okay.
Back in 1980.
Wow.
Very beginnings of the comedy boom.
Now, what happened? You started doing it. Now, what made you want to get into comedy? I mean,
I graduated from college and didn't want to get a job.
Okay. Now, you went to Yale.
Yeah.
And you played football.
Yeah.
And so, see, people, here's the guy. He's smart. He's a good-looking guy. He's funny. And he's intelligent. So, like, you screwed up for all us other comics. I hope you know that. We're like, wait, we're okay-looking. We're sort of smart. But I suck at sports. But, no, were you always a good athlete as a kid? I mean, to play college football.
I kind of grew up in that culture and Northeast Ohio. And it was, you know, football, baseball, basketball. Those are the sports.
Now, what was your favorite?
Actually, my favorite sport is baseball, but I was best at football.
Okay, and you were a defensive back,
I was defensive back, running back all through high school and even my freshman year of college, and I returned punts, and so, you know.
Now, did you go to Yale for football, or did they recruit you, or just?
Yeah, I went to a very small Catholic prep school in Ohio, and I was mildly recruited.
Okay.
And I ended up actually having a fairly decent career at Yale, aided by low expectations.
Okay, so how was it playing? I mean, it's funny because I went to one of my friends played for Princeton for 1 year.
Yeah.
And we used to go up to Princeton and I grew up in Trejo, New Jersey. Sure. He was from Philly. And we were just, first of all, when you go, you know, growing up and going to like Eagles games or whatever games, you know, it's cheesesteaks and all that. But when you go to an Ivy League tailgating, it's amazing. I'm sitting there going, tri-tip and lamb and wine.
Champagne,
So what were you, was your team good? Because I remember I saw Columbia when they were like, had lost like 28 games in a row. They were playing Princeton. I'm thinking the guys in the band are getting hit more than the football players.
We were good. It was the late 70s. I played varsity from 76 through 76, 77, 78, and we won the championship, Ivy League championship, two of those years.
Okay, cool.
And so we were always good, which was kind of interesting for me because I came from a small town and always went to small schools, and we always got our ass kicked.
Oh, really? So you weren't a good team.
So finally, you know, I go to college and I become an ass kicker.
Well, that's awesome. Now, were you
not me personally?
Yeah, but your team. Yeah, were you interested in comedy when you were in college or when you were younger? Did you listen to certain comics or?
Well, I was. Yeah, I had comedy albums. I had George Carlin and Bill Cosby, and it only made sense in retrospect.
Okay,
because I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and I had no idea. I would watch comedians on Johnny Carson. I would literally tape Don Rickles when he would guest host The Tonight Show with my little reel-to-reel tape.
Remember that? You always sit there and, shh, you brother, keep it down. I'm taping it. Be quiet. I missed the beginning.
Exactly. But I never knew where these people came from or where you could actually make a living at this kind of thing. So it never occurred to me that that was a career option.
Okay.
Until I started going down to this comedy club in Cleveland. I'd been out of school for about a year.
Already graduated.
I'd graduated. A lot of my friends were either going to graduate school, law school, medical school.
Now, what was your major?
I was an English major.
Now, did you want to write, or I mean, what was?
I had some idea that I wanted to be a writer. You know, like writing short stories like Woody Allen for the New Yorker, Bill, that kind of thing.
Those, have you ever? He has that book of like I remember I had a book and I lent it to someone and never got it back.
Yeah, Without Feathers.
All three of his. Yeah, but there's all three in one volume.
Oh, right, right.
Amazing his stuff. I mean, oh, it's just such when death shows up and just
yes.
Oh, it's just amazing.
So I was kind of a fan of that.
Okay,
although you know. There's no way you really can make a living doing that kind of thing. But that's kind of what I thought I would do. But I was really at loose ends. I didn't want to work for Procter & Gamble or anything like that. So I went home and kind of hung out for a year at my parents' indulgence. And luckily, I had enough credit in the bank, so to speak, in the psychic bank. That they allowed didn't bug me too much about hanging around the house for 6 months, and I found out about this club. I saw this ad in the paper for this club, a Cleveland Comedy Club.
Okay.
Downtown Cleveland, which at that time in the late 70s, just like the New York had gone bankrupt in the 70s, and it was a shell of an industrial town.
Right.
And there was nothing around there. It was in this old Greek restaurant in the middle of nowhere.
That's funny.
In dark downtown Cleveland. And I started going down there. These four young guys had bought this place, and they were in their early 20s like I was, and they were bringing in comics from L.A. Bob Saget was like a big okay. headliner there. Bruce Babyman Baum.
Okay.
Gary Shandling. Vic Dunlap, God rest his soul.
Right.
Ollie Joe Prater. All these people.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, guy was.
He was a crazy man too. What's that?
He passed away.
Yes. He. That was you.
I've heard. I heard a story.
You could see
one
that
time.
Coming.
Yeah, I heard a story. One of my friends was working with him, and I believe they. He was, himself, and they lighted him. They gave him the light.
Yeah,
and he went, "Well, no one gives me the light," and he just went off. And
well,
it's
his
like,
opening bit, he had a mug of beer on the stage on the stool, and he had some trick where he would drink this mug of beer without using his hands.
Oh God!
And he would just chug it, and that was boom.
You do three shows a night, man. That's going to hit
you.
Oh, yeah.
And he's doing coke down in the basement.
That's funny.
And it was an eye-opening thing for me.
So all these guys, are there? Now, was there crowds coming out?
There were crowds. It was packed every night. It was,
it was in a little area. So, I mean, but no, there was no other comedy going in Cleveland.
Nothing going on. There's no life.
Right.
It was like a moonscape.
Okay. All right.
So this was like a little beacon of light. And my dad came to see me once. Got his car stolen down there.
Oh wow.
a little Olds Cutlass, and they found it 4 days later. And we used to tease him because they took everything off the car, the doors, everything, and left one of his ties on the seat. He felt insulted by that. But I started going down there like January, early 1980, as a customer. And I'm seeing Dave Coulier, who was younger than I was at the time, because he started
he
was 19
kid.
Or 20.
Yeah.
Mike Binder, who was also a very young guy, Jimmy Alec, all these guys who were not that much older than me doing this. And I really enjoyed it because I always enjoyed comedy, but never thought, as I said before, that you could actually make a career.
Right,
out of it.
Or how, the whole thing when I started, it was like, I didn't know how to get into it.
Yeah.
It was the same thing. I got out of college with my parents, and they're like, well, you want to do comedy? And my mom gave me a learning annex thing in Philadelphia. Yeah. And I remember Brian McKim and Tracy Skeen were my teachers. And for me, it was just a matter of, wow, okay, I can do it now. So you started watching these
I
shows.
I started watching these guys like it was in January, and by March, I decided they had an amateur night. They called amateur night, which was Sundays. And that was the wildest night, because what they would do was two things. They would encourage you to bring your own people, because the winner would be voted on by the crowd.
Okay.
That's how they got people there. And they also labeled it heckle night. Literally encouraged heckling. They would give a Cleveland Comedy Club t-shirt to the best heckle of the night.
It's always great when you've never been on stage. That's what you want to look forward to.
Oh, my God. It must have set the Cleveland local scene back 5 years, because poor people would get up there, and before they said a word, people would be screaming at them just to get a t-shirt.
Man.
And I remember I went up there. I brought a table full of people, a couple of college friends of mine who were in town, and set a tape recorder on the table. And did my little 10-minute set and bombed, just like everybody else was bombing. And somehow they were able to outvote everybody else. So I was terrible. Everybody else was worse. I remember some like biker guy there who looked like he was just going to kill everybody. And the competition wasn't great.
Right.
So I won the $30. And
you're hooked.
I came back the next week or 2 weeks later with different material. And
once again on the amateur night?
On the amateur night.
Okay.
Was much better, actually. But there was a guy who just blew me out of the water. So he won the $30. But Dino, Vince, who was the owner of the club, one of the owners, came up to me afterwards and said, I'll pay you $30 a week to MC, probably every other week or every 2 weeks. Would you like to do that? And I went, okay, sure. I'm not doing anything else. And it kind of, I just found myself putting a lot of energy into thinking of jokes, because once I started doing it, I was thinking of jokes and I just liked hanging out with comics.
Yeah, I try to explain it to people. It's a different, I got out of the business for a very long time, and I recently got back into the business like a year and a half ago. And that's one thing I miss. Even like I hang out, like if I go to Flappers, the new club down here, if I hang out with some of the younger comics, they've been around. They're like, we talk, but it's just, there's just like a certain energy you can't explain. Like just, it's like when you're around with comics, just like, it's just so casual, but it's so cool. It's weird.
I like the way they thought about the world. I liked hanging out with the comics. I liked the way that they were usually, even if they weren't highly educated, they were smart.
Right,
because
exactly.
You can't be dumb and be a comic, because you're kind of filtering life and putting it through perspective, that doesn't require education. It just requires sort of a native IQ. So that was always interesting, and so I was doing this, and I for about 6 months.
Now, was there other guys, like let's say you were the house MC or whatever, were there other Cleveland guys who were also getting the opportunity?
Yeah, there were a couple other guys, not that many, though.
Okay, so that's always cool.
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of comedy. It was really at the embryonic stages of what was known as the comedy boom of the 80s. And so I was, one of the regular MCs and got to meet all these guys. But they were all coming from they were all booked from the West Coast.
Okay.
And there was a show called Make Me Laugh on at that
Bobby
time.
Bobby Van.
Yes. And these guys were all, that was their draw.
Okay.
From TV.
I remember.
Not like
show.
Today with the kids, with the internet and the streaming and everything.
I know. It's...
So that was it. You had to have some TV credit, and this was the TV credit. And like Saget was like a cult figure there, and it was funny because I knew Bob before Full House, and everybody knew how funny and how really dirty he was.
Well, that's funny. Yeah,
and then he gets this reputation as this wholesome guy on Full
House.
That always
cracks me up, because I remember a good friend of mine, Jeff Martyr. I don't know if you know Jeff.
Sure, I know Jeff.
But me and Jeff used to write jokes for a website together, and Jeff's a very good friend. And he had said, like, he was back when San Diego had, like, the Comedy Store and another thing, like, Saget, they'd put you in the condos, and he'd walk back down the street in San Diego, and there'd be Saget on the patio before this playing a guitar, just seemed like the filthiest songs. And it was just insane.
And he had a cadence in his act that all the local Cleveland acts would start absorbing and imitating. You could tell when Saget had been in town.
That's funny.
Because all the local comics were talking like him.
So you're in Cleveland. So now what made you... You went to New York after Cleveland, right?
Yes, I was in Cleveland, and my girlfriend, who's now my wife, at the time was in Europe. She was in Italy, and she has no idea that her college boyfriend is now becoming a comedian. And
this Yale graduate is doing stand-up. What?
Yes. Well, she was an artist, so she was crazy,
so
too.
Was cool. That was good. That's cool. At least she was an artist. It wasn't like she was an MBA in training, like, oh, you can't do comedy.
No. Well, if she was, maybe she could have supported me a little through this. As it was the other way around. But I started asking. I wanted to go to New York because I knew that's where she was going to end up.
Okay.
And so I started asking around, can you do this in New York?
Right.
And as I said, like only in retrospect did it make sense. Only in retrospect did I look back and see a lot of things that were significant to me as a kid growing up were things where I was in front of an audience, entertaining, either singing or making people laugh.
In your household or in school?
Yeah, in the household,
plays,
in the school, and even in college. It all kind of made sense in retrospect. And my dad was really my model, because he was a guy who was always asked to be the MC for the church event or the local Maple Festival, which was we had in my little town of Chardon, which I'm wearing the shirt of.
Yeah, I saw that. Okay.
And so I would look at him and see that, oh, this is fun. He's getting all this attention. He's commanding this room. It's such a powerful position.
Right, right, right.
So unlike a lot of comics, I really don't fit the profile of the comic who is always beat up or who's a lousy athlete or anything
right,
like
yeah,
that.
Right, yeah. It's funny because I was always popular. But, I mean, when I was young, I got made fun of because I'm legally blind one eye.
Uh-huh.
And, but then in high school, it was fine. But I'm the same way. And it's like my parents, I came from a very good family.
Yeah, same thing.
My dad was very quiet. My mom was a marketing executive before yeah. there was marketing people. And then she left her job to raise the kids. And she was always outgoing. And so it's the same way. I wasn't like, you know, the kid who was beaten and sat in a corner, you know?
No, not at all. My dad was a funny guy. And my mom was a great audience. So I had the perfect combination.
Oh, yes, perfect.
Of a couple there where my mom would laugh at the same jokes over and over. And my mom was particularly actually a fan of fart jokes. That was kind of her secret thing.
That's great.
And but anyway, it was more about, oh, that's a position of power,
right.
Not I have to be funny in order not to be beat up.
Right, right, right.
And because there was all this work out there, people like me all of a sudden, you know, had an opportunity. So after about 6 months working in Cleveland, I moved to New York and started hanging out at the clubs there and passed the comic strip and then eventually at the Improv and Catch a Rising Star and did all the – and then it really boomed. There were clubs all over Manhattan, all up and down the East Coast.
Did you know any other comics when you moved to New York? I mean, because you said you'd mostly work with L.A. comics, but there was a whole – that I'm trying to think. Who was in like, – when you first got there, you got there in 80, did you say?
Yes, when I got there
– Mario Joyner
was after.
Okay.
Eddie Murphy – it was before Eddie Murphy was famous, only months before he was
famous.
Okay,
he was got broke at the comic strip, right?
He was at the comic strip, and I watch him, and you know, he was 19 years old, and he was brilliant performer. He was copying a lot of, you know, he was doing like a Dick Gregory bit,
right, right,
and a, you know, Richard Pryor bit. But he would do characters, and he was obviously what I saw in him, this 19-year-old kid who, you know, 4 years younger than I was, just extreme confidence.
Right.
Okay. He was just born to this. This is an example of a guy who knew what he wanted to do.
Right. Okay.
And he wanted to be Bob Hope and Elvis. He wanted to be like two white guys, actually,
yeah.
Oddly enough. But he was, it was like a couple months before he broke, you know, on Saturday Night Live and got cast as
right.
a, kind of a featured player and then, you know,
just,
a year later,
boom,
then just
yeah.
took off. And that was kind of amazing to watch. Paul Reiser, I was around when Paul Reiser auditioned for Diner. And
okay.
I remember him coming to the comics, telling the story about how he, you know,
huge
how that,
fan of that
accidentally
movie. Yeah,
happened, how he went with another buddy and they called him in, and then he had all this Diner material that he would do.
That's
you
funny.
Know, you know, so it was perfect. When
well, I heard Levinson, it was a very small part, but Barry Levinson liked him so much, he built the
expanded it, yeah.
Which is awesome. So those guys were hanging out. So they were like the little class before you.
Yeah, Seinfeld had just gone to L.A.
Okay.
But Joel Bolster, Mark Schiff, up at the comic strip. At the Improv, it was Rick Overton. He was like an idol of mine. I just thought he was. I had seen him in college.
Me and him keep emailing back and forth, and we want to set a date down for the show, but because I want him because he's awesome.
Yeah.
But it's always like he's always on set somewhere because the guy he does movies.
He's working.
And he works.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I'm like, I want to get you on here, but it's just so funny you set him because every comic raves about him.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
he's just comics.
Yeah, he's
awesome.
Like the guy that every you know all the comics know, and let's see Overton and. John Mendoza, you had mentioned
right.
before, was at the Improv, and Bill Maher was at Catch a Rising Star.
Okay.
And, you know, it was that cohort.
So you guys are all hanging out, and then I guess because you're getting work, all of a sudden.
I'm not hanging out with those guys. Those guys are, like, higher right, than me. I'm hanging out with my guys.
Like Lou DiMaggio.
Like Lou DiMaggio, okay. John Heyman, Scott Blakeman,
okay.
Tom Saunders.
That's just
why
you guys like the group before me.
Yeah.
Remember, so you're sitting there hanging out with these guys, and you're getting past the clubs, you're getting stage time,
yeah.
And then the boom takes off, right?
Yeah.
So immediately, do you guys go out on the road, or what do you do?
Well, what was interesting was that when I first got to town, being an MC was like the prime position because
right.
they got the most. You get $100 to MC at the showcase clubs in New York, and so the best comics were the MCs. Belzer,
okay,
Ronnie Shakes, people like that. They would MC because that was the most money. And then all of a sudden, you had one nighters in New Jersey happening. A guy named Jerry Stanley, a guy named Jim Balazzo's.
I know both.
I
played the comic strip in Lauderdale for Balazzo's.
Yeah, they'd pay $55-$60 a set for a half hour set. Three comics would go out, and then the road work like the Cleveland Comedy Club, more clubs like that started opening, where it was the Wednesday through Saturday,
okay,
or Tuesday through Saturday, Wednesday through Sunday, whatever. And so the really established comics who had enough material could go out on the road and make some money. Actually, I should mention one of my other co-writers, still one of my best friends, Dom Herrera. He and I came up together.
You want to hear something funny? The receptionist?
Yeah.
The one with the white glasses?
Yeah.
It's Dom Herrera's goddaughter. She never knew how big her godfather is, but every comic I tell her, like, oh my God, Dom. She's like, I didn't know he was such. I said, he's a legend.
Yeah.
That's his. I always tell her, she always gets embarrassed. She's like, would you stop? I go, but all these people love Dom Herrera.
Yeah. Dom was one of my best friends, and actually, I got him his first headlining gig.
Okay.
Because what happened was, I called Dino at the comedy club after I'd been in New York for less than a year, and it was a summertime, and I said, I got this guy, I want to come back, an MC, but I got this guy who'd be a good headliner. His name's Dom Herrera, and he didn't know who he was.
Right.
And, you know, Dom didn't have an hour of material.
Right.
He maybe not even 45 minutes. Okay. But I told him that he could do it, and Dom said, okay. So we drove down. I had a little Opel GT at the time. It was just a two-seater car, and I drove, Dom and I drove down to Philly. We visited his mother and grandmother, spent the night, and drove from Philly across Pennsylvania to Cleveland.
Okay.
And it was on my recommendation that Dom is going to headline, and it's Wednesday night, opening night, and fortunately, it happens to be a hot night, and Dom gets up there, and he's, you know, he's got material, but he's also a good improvisationalist, and somehow fakes his way through a 45-50 minute set.
Funny.
Kills, and then, you know, is able to do it the next night and build on that, and he had a pretty successful little week there, and then I never saw him again. He just hit the road.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, then he became Dom the Road Warrior, you know, and he's just, you know, he's still doing it.
We're going to take a break.
Okay.
We're here with Steve Skrovan. Remember, people, Cooper, 925-KYHY.com. Send me an email. This Friday, 11:30 at Flappers in the Yoohoo Room. I'll be headlining the United Colors of Comedy. It's $5 to get in, and it's happy hour throughout the show. So come on out and send me an email. I'd like to hear from you people. And the fifth emailer who lives in this area will get free tickets. So send me an email. We'll be right back with Steve Skrovan. We'll be talking more comedy, and we're going to take a break.
Yeah, it's Cooper Talk, baby. Never miss a show again. KYHY on the go. Tune in on your smartphone. Visit www.925kyhy.com and click the smartphone link.
Fairy residents, Tooth speaking. Sorry, there's no credit fairy here. What's that? He magically raises your credit score? Yeah, there's no credit fairy. But you can improve your credit by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low. Money under your pillow? Sorry, kids only.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. Brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
For 10 years now, the Indie Bible has helped thousands of independent artists gain more exposure for their music. The 10th edition features 4,200 publications that will review independent music and 3,400 radio stations that will play independent songs. It also includes hundreds of labels, distributors, and digital download sites. Over 9,000 contacts in all. Included are 50 helpful articles written by music industry experts. The Indie Bible shows musicians where they can get their music reviewed, their songs played, and their CDs sold. For details and to order online, visit www.indiebible.com. From country to rock, hip-hop, reggae, rhythm, blues, alternative, metal, and jazz, we are independent music.
Independent music.
The Y.
The Y.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. Remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. We're here with Steve Skrovan. And as we know, so you were talking about Steve. Steve's got the stories, you know, because every comic has great stories. That's the one thing. It's like, and just the Opel. I remember those cars. I had a Fiero when I was doing comedy, which was like the worst, like the little two-seat tin can.
Well, this Opel, it was a poor man's Corvette.
Okay.
And it was no good for comedy because it only had two seats. because those one-nighters are talking about New Jersey.
Three acts.
So you could get work. You could be a kind of a bad comedian, but if you had a car, you could work because you could drive the other two comedians. But I had an Opel GT, which was only a two-seater. It did me no good. And it also had this problem where it would stall. And a couple of times I stalled in the Lincoln Tunnel.
Oh, that'd be awful.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, horrendous. I eventually got rid of it because I didn't need it in New York. It was just, you know, a pain in the ass. But
so how long were you on the road? Now you started. Now you're in New York. Now did you do the Master? I remember. Were you like on MTV Comedy Hour? Or were you on some of those shows? I know you were. I remember seeing you in some of those shows.
Well, I actually hosted a talk show on MTV in 1988. It was called Mouth to Mouth.
Okay.
It was on for 6 weeks in from Halloween till like the second week of December.
Okay.
And that was. I don't know if I did like the MTV Comedy Show, but I was actually. A host of the show, which was a big break for me because it was a live call-in talk show. They had gotten a lot of they'd always just shown videos. Now, you know, they don't show videos.
I know, it's crazy. I remember like growing up, and I remember we were like my area was one of the first to get MTV, and I remember because the first video was Buggles Video Killed the Radio Star,
right.
Which is very funny because years later in Burbank I used to have beers every once in a while with the guy Jeff Downs, who was in Buggles.
Oh, wow.
And was in Asia and was in Yes, and I saw Yes in the round at because him and the guy from Buggles joined. I saw him at the Spectrum,
right.
I'm thinking, God, this is when I was like in 11th grade, now I'm having beers with this guy years later. But they used to, that was the whole thing, the videos would break artists. I mean, an artist if, like Duran, if they came out now, I mean, they got the videos because they were good looking guys and they were different, and now it's just, you know, crazy.
Well, at that time MTV was mainly showing videos. The only other programming they had, original programming, was Remote Control.
Okay.
My friends, two other cohorts from my, you know, Kenny Ober and Colin Quinn did that show, and they had MTV had a lot of success with their call-in request line.
Okay.
So they wanted to do something with phones, and they hired this producer, who a guy named Dave DiGiovanni, who produced for Peter Jennings. They brought him in to build a show around phones.
Okay.
And they created all of these gimmicks. They were going to have phones, call-ins, have guests, musical guests, actors, anybody in culture. It would be live. We would have theme audiences. Like, you know, one time we had, you know, witches from the East Village.
Okay.
And they kind of built this concept of a show and then had to find somebody. It's like they built this F-15 fighter plane and had to find somebody who had the skills to fly it.
Okay. Now, how long were you doing comedy at the time?
By this time, it's about 7 years, seven, 8 years.
Okay. Now, you were making your living going on the road?
I was making my living, going on the road.
Were you doing any writing at the time, like paid writing? Or?
Yeah, I was doing sketch writing. I was writing sketches. I had a show, a little cabaret show myself with a group that I'd formed, and we called the show Live Scro Acts on Stage.
Okay.
And it looked like, you know, one of those gay porn ads.
Okay.
And it was just sketches that I wrote, and we did it at a place called Who's On First on the East Side and the Manhattan Punchline, which is on Theater Row. And I did that with some other friends of mine, including Fred Stoller, who you may know.
I remember when he used to come into Philly because it was like, because in Philly could have, and he was so much more of a, did you ever play Philly?
Oh, sure.
You probably played the Works.
No, I played the Outlet.
Oh,
mostly.
Did you? Okay,
I played the Works, but mostly the Outlet.
I worked the door.
Salted popcorn.
Oh, yeah. I worked the door when I started out to get stage time at the Outlet. Because it was me and a few other guys, me and Keith Robinson and this kid Steve Thomas. And we used to work the door because we knew we didn't have to wait in line for the open mic there. And we got a slot. And so it was like, and you would sit there and we saw so many great comics.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was saying, because Freddie played the Outlet.
Yeah.
And he just seemed much more of a Works guy because his delivery, Freddie, Funk, you know, but because the Outlet crowd would be brutal. I mean, that was like that was like the blue collar crowd, and the Works was like the yuppie crowd.
Right, big difference. Right, yeah. Well, I worked the Outlet mostly, and you know, so we met Grover Silcox,
one of the funniest people ever,
Shoemaker.
Okay,
and those guys. But what were you talking about?
We were talking about so you were doing some writing, but you were making
that,
but then they paid. Now, was it a big audition process or what happened?
Well, apparently. It was funny because it came kind of sideways. It came through my commercial agent, this audition. And it was just basically an interview. And it was me as Dave interviewing people. And then I got a call back for it. And what I found out later was they had been looking forever for somebody because they'd put all of these bells and whistles on this show, and they needed somebody who had the skills.
Right.
And because I was a comic, I was used to working live. I used to being spontaneous. I could deal with – I had enough of an eclectic knowledge of the world of – you know, culture and everything that fit.
And if you didn't know, you could just bullshit your way through.
Yes, and I was cheap, which MTV probably still is.
Right.
And
they played those MTV comedy specials like 87 times. Like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like over and over and over.
Well, Doug Herzog, I remember, who's now, you know, running Comedy Central, was the, you know, we're about the same age. He was about 30 years old at the time. He was the big VP there,
okay.
The Wunderkind VP. And I remember him saying, we're like the Army. It's a good place to start. Because they like to start people there, and then as soon as they got expensive, goodbye. So here we're doing this live talk show from Monday through Thursday, and I hire – the first two guys I call are Scott Carter and Michael King.
Okay.
Scott Carter is produced Politically Incorrect subsequently, and now Real Time with Bill Maher.
Okay.
Michael Patrick King is now this mogul who's doing Two Broke Girls.
And didn't he do Sex and the City?
He's Sex and the City. Okay. Ran Sex and the City. He's won Emmys. And my friend Mike Rowe – who just
he's
won an
Futurama,
Emmy.
Futurama, right?
Yeah, they just won an Emmy.
I just sent him an email about being on the show. I didn't hear back from him.
I'll tell him because he's got some great stories.
I can imagine because I remember him from those watching.
Yeah.
I remember you guys from MTV.
But those were my three. They've all done very well for themselves.
Okay, so they all came and helped you.
They all came writers, and there were a couple other writers. MTV hired a couple of guys. There's one guy named Glenn Eichler who's one of our writers who's now like one of the head writers for Colbert. And
okay.
He was just a great, you know. But this was too big for MTV at the time. It was too much. We had an office in the Brill Building, and you know, I'm interviewing four or five people a night. It was just this huge operation. MTV, I think they realized they were way in over their head at that point. And because the show actually was getting ratings,
right?
But and there also may have been some political things between some of the VPs, because the general managers, you know, it was all this kind of stuff. And 2 weeks before Christmas, they pulled a plug on the show, which surprised all of us because we thought, hey,
getting ratings, it's
we're
hit,
just finding our, you know, we're just finding, you know, ourselves. And I felt like I didn't get a chance to really develop as a good interviewer yet. But I was,
it's like me. I mean, I'm still learning. I've only been doing this for a little over a year, but in the beginning, I didn't know. It takes a while, and that's the thing they don't get. And if you start off, and if it's a hit, if it's doing well when you start off, just think what it's going to do in 6 months when you hit. It's like comedy when you hit that stride. I mean, it's
a point of view,
and you get with your writers, and you guys know they know exactly what they're writing for you and stuff like that.
Yeah, so we didn't really get to that point. Although by the end, in 6 weeks, I'd probably done 100 interviews because we're doing four or five a night.
Okay,
and it was a great time in New York, and that was my first regular TV gig. And then the year after that, actually less than a year after that, the next spring, I got a job out here, and this brought me out here to host a show called Totally Hidden Video, which was on the fledgling Fox Network at the time.
That's funny.
They had America's Most Wanted and Married with Children were their programs on Sunday night, and it was just like 6 months before The Simpsons, actually.
Okay, wow.
And actually, The Simpsons took our time slot on Sunday and moved us to Saturday. But then I was on that show.
Had they known your work from the other show? Is that how
it worked? I think I was hired off of the tape from the MTV show.
Okay, so you started doing that. So now, when did you make your transition into the writing? I mean, because you wrote sketch, but you were basically making your bread and butter doing comedy, but being a host,
right?
And a lot of times you don't think, you know, like with hosts, you don't think hosts as writers. I mean, that's the thing. It's like,
yeah,
you know, or the not. I mean, it's different back then, but the atypical now. I can't see Mario Lopez like writing a Das Boot Part 3. You know,
right?
So what happened? So you're hosting this show now. How long did you host the show for?
That was just for a year.
Okay,
that was for although it was 39 episodes. It was a year, a calendar year, and then I got didn't get renewed for that job. The show went on. But you know, they the show went on for like another year and a half, maybe 2 years with about half a dozen different hosts.
Okay.
After that,
all right.
They just could not replace me, Steve. That's what
see,
I'm trying
that's
to
what
say.
It is. They said, and we want that Scrovan.
Well, they ended up actually the final host, I think, was Mark Pitta, who's was a guy that I went up against on Star Search. He beat me on Star Search, and when I met him in the hallway before Star Search, we looked at each other and thought we could be brothers.
Oh, that's
we
funny.
Look alike.
That's funny.
And even we did, you know, a lot of people say, hey, you look like that. And you go, well, no, I don't. But Mark and I looked at each other and go, Wow,
that's funny.
We could
that's
be brothers,
funny.
And they ended up going through all these different hosts, and then ending up with Mark Pitta, who was basically me. So that's the way I justify that failure.
Yes, they exactly.
So transitioning into writing.
Because your first writing was with Seinfeld, or
that was the first writing job. Yes,
okay.
But my friend David Fury, who's a writer now, he's not on Fringe. He was of a long time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. But he and I had written sketches too.
Okay.
Not together, but separately, and actually in a theater show that he did out here called Mental Cruelty and Sentimental Cruelty. So, and we were old friends from New York.
Okay.
He was a writer, and he and his wife, Ellen, I guess they were married at the time, yeah. Dave said to me, you know, you should come every Tuesday. We meet with a bunch of Alan was in this class at UCLA, and a bunch of the people who were in this comedy writing class are still meeting on Tuesday nights. And
okay.
We just read each other's material. And I think, you know, you have this sketch that you did, I think would be a good Seinfeld story. So why don't you come and work on it?
Seinfeld was already on.
Seinfeld was already on. It was still cult status.
It was still, because it was originally called the Seinfeld Chronicles.
Chronicles, yeah, although it never officially was. It was, yeah.
Because there was a show called the Marshall Chronicles.
That's
and they
right.
They didn't see that they canceled. Like,
exactly.
So they had to, which is just funny in the retrospect. It's like, but
right.
Seinfeld, I think, would have been different if it was called Seinfeld. I mean, that's what makes it great. It's just the title Seinfeld.
Right. So he said, come, and you know, we meet every Tuesday. Nobody knows what they're talking about or anything. We're just a bunch of people who are aspiring, you know, writers. And so I went. And what it did was it gave you a deadline,
right,
an artificial
okay.
deadline to do something if you want to participate. Because we'd all just read each other's stuff out loud, and you get to hear it and get all the comments and, you know, whether they were useful or not. It was more the exercise of bringing something in and being
right.
in the arena, having people talk about opportunities.
And making sure you get it done. Because, you know, writers, we always procrastinate. But now you say, I have to, because you don't want to just show up with not anything, because then
yeah.
you look like, who's this guy who's just showing up with nothing?
Exactly. It was actually the equivalent of hanging out in the bar at the comedy clubs.
Okay.
You know, where I had to convince my wife, when in those New York days, that when I'm in the bar, I can't put all my focus on you because this is my
right.
workplace. I'm actually working.
Exactly, yeah.
Because
it's,
you're networking, you're
yeah.
finding out where jobs are, you're hanging out, you're
yeah,
showing your face.
Totally.
It's
totally.
Work.
Yeah, exactly.
So this was kind of the equivalent of that. And so I developed this sketch into a Seinfeld episode spec script.
Okay.
Thinking, you know, maybe I can get it to Larry, because I knew Larry from the New York comedy days, and maybe he'd buy an idea from it, because
right.
I knew he was buying ideas. And my manager, Abby, actually handed the script to him, and he called me up in 92, and I was really kind of at loose ends, because I was in between. I was, you know, not making much money. I'd come off that show on Fox and everything, and he said, do you want a job?
Wow.
And I said, sure. And he had hired me and my friend John Heyman, my friend Bob Shaw, and my friend Bill Masters.
Okay.
All
I,
New
I
York
worked
comics.
With Bill at the Comedy Works. I remember the beard. He always had a beard.
Yes.
Yes.
And he hired all of us to, the four of us, to be, not to write, because he wanted to do all the writing, but to be kind of a think tank.
Okay.
To come in, and he gave us this title called Program Consultant.
Okay.
And we were just sit in a room and try to think of premises and then pitch them to Larry. And then if he liked it, he would go off and maybe write a script about it.
Okay.
That was the theory. And so all of a sudden, I'm on the show, which is still a cult following. But halfway through the year, they were on Wednesday nights and getting their ass kicked by Home Improvement every
okay.
night. Then halfway through the year, it moves to Thursday.
All right.
And bang, it's top 10, maybe even top 5.
Out of just, okay.
And they never look back. It was just from that on. So it was a very exciting year to be there.
Right.
To watch that happen and be a part of that. And when I say that was my first writing job, I feel it was like more, I was auditing a class.
Okay.
More than writing. It was more like that. We ended up writing a script, three of us, Bill and John and I, and ended up writing a script with our names on it.
The movie?
It was the movie, yes. Yeah. Not one of my favorite Seinfeld episodes, but it was.
But hey, still,
but we got it on the air.
And you know, bottom line is, once you have that, I mean, that's just cool in the beginning to see your name. Like,
yes.
Wow, look at that. You know,
yeah.
And it's a hit.
Yeah, but and Larry and Jerry were very open about letting us participate in all part of the process to hear
that's
the notes
so cool.
And did, you know, so it was like literally and how they developed an idea And I remember Jerry using the term surfing on the premise. Like you take a small idea and then you say, okay, now what happens next? What are the consequences of that? What are the consequences
right,
of that?
Right, okay.
And you just, and that's what they would do.
Okay, we're
go ahead.
Sorry, we're going to take a quick break.
We'll be
right. I want to keep this going because I love this Seinfeld talk. Anyway, we're here with Steve Skrovan. Also, send me an email, cooper925kyhy.com, and Flappers this Friday at 11:30, United Colors of Comedy. I'll be headlining. So come on out. We'll be right back with Steve Skrovan.
92.5 The Y, radio that finally makes sense.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Need to restore your credit? Don't know where to go or who to trust? Let United Credit Education Services assist you in restoring your credit. Now, why choose them? They are members of the Better Business Bureau with no complaints. They offer a written, yes, a written money-back guarantee. They have assisted their customers in having over 300,000 negative items deleted from their credit profiles. Late payments, repossessions, tax liens, public records, student loans, foreclosures, judgments, child support, and collections. Their staff has over 20 years of experience in credit restoration. So call now and get the process going and get in that credit score you deserve. Call for that free consultation at 310-864-6258. That's 310-864-6258. Or you can reach them at 310-713-8653. That's 310-713-8653. And the first 50 callers to mention they heard this ad on What's High Radio gets $100 off of their services. It's United Credit Education Services. Check them out. Use them. I use them. They helped me, and they can help you. Check them out.
You know those shows that play the same boring pop songs over and over again every 15 minutes? This ain't that show. Billboard bands, sellout musicians, and phony boy bands need not apply. Independent music is played here. It's Cooper Talk, baby.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Send me an email, cooper925kyhy.com. We're here in conversation with Steve Skrovan, and we're talking about the Seinfeld, and he's going to tell us some good Seinfeld stories. Because how many years did you work on it?
Just the 1 year.
Okay, but God, but that must have, you must have, like, I could just imagine a year, and that must have, like, grown your writing, like, four
oh, yeah.
times.
Yeah, at least you know, the way to think about it. And I remember being there. We were all out to dinner at the Daily Grill pitching Larry stories, and Bob Shaw pitched Larry some story about it was some masturbation theme. And Larry said, you know, I've already got an idea that I'm thinking about George's mother catching him masturbating. And that was the first we heard of that famous episode,
that
which
was like,
became the context.
Like, yeah, that was a classic one. I remember when I came out. It was like, I remember I was sitting there because I was doing I had a gig, and I actually taped it, and there was a comic named, I don't know if you know a guy from New York named Ray Panetti.
Sure.
And Ray and me were, I think we had been like away, like co-headlining like a Keith Gisser thing. And I came back, and my ex-wife had taped it, and I watched it like three times. It was just so... so funny. That was like that episode was like classic.
It was brilliant. Yeah, it was brilliant. And because for me, thinking masturbating, how do you write about masturbating?
Right,
you
know, exactly. It's such a taboo subject usually. And then
yes, but that's what Larry was after. He was after those things you didn't see on television normally, and that's what excited him. And he found a way to do it and became part of the culture now. You know,
okay.
Master of your domain.
Everyone knows it. That's yeah. There's so many things. You know, that's one thing that's amazing about that show is. There's just terms, and it's more, and now because it's in syndication, younger people get it, but like sponge-worthy and different stuff. Like there's certain terms that came from that show that people just
yeah,
love.
They're part of the culture. It was a cultural.
So you drama. Worked there for a year.
Yes.
Now, I know, was your next show Everyone Loves Raymond, or?
No. Actually, I didn't get work after that. I think I did an outside script for Dying English, which didn't turn out very well. And I was bouncing around. I got a job writing sketches for a group called Culture Clash out here in L.A.
Oh,
three guys.
Latino group.
And that was about 3 months. And then from that, I got a job writing animation.
Okay.
At Klasky Chupo for a show called Ah, Real Monsters.
Okay.
That was co-created, actually, by one of my other writers from the MTV show, a guy named Peter Gaffney.
Well, that's funny.
And so it all kind of came full circle. And writing animation was a whole different experience, because that's like you're writing a 18-page action-adventure movie.
Okay.
In when you're writing sitcoms, it's more film theater, and so
right.
It's all about the words. But you're writing a cartoon, it's about the images and about the action, and it's more cinematic and movie-like, and the words are like the last resort to communicate anything. And so that was a great exercise to go through, and it, even though it was just 18 pages, you had to have a three-act structure.
Right,
six pages. That was just a tremendous lot of fun, because you could really let your imagination go. And I did that, I think, 3 or 4 months, too. And then Larry, who was great to me, just not only giving me the job, but then allowing me afterwards, I was the warm-up on the show.
Okay, so you were doing your...
I did that. And then somebody called George Lucas called him.
The George Lucas?
The George Lucas called him, because they were looking for a guy to write an educational video. George Lucas wanted to do this educational movie about education in the year 2025.
Okay.
Because he's got a foundation, George Lucas Educational Foundation. And there was a script that was written, but it wasn't very interesting, because it wasn't funny.
Right.
And there wasn't much conflict in it, because he's trying to describe this utopian world of education in the year 2025. And George Lucas was really one of the pioneers of the four-story sort of arcs.
Okay.
From American Graffiti. If you remember American Graffiti, he was following these four different characters through their stories. And what Larry had done, kind of the innovation he had done, is he had done that now in comedy.
Right.
Sitcoms
okay.
weren't like that before.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And he kind of evolved a way to – he found these great four characters, and they each had their own story arcs, and they would intersect and run parallel to each other. And so I guess Lucas saw that and said, oh, here's a guy who knows how to do the four-story thing. He called Larry, and Larry, of course, didn't have time, and he was good enough to recommend me.
Okay.
So I interviewed with these people from the George Lucas Educational Foundation. Next thing I know, I'm up at Skywalker Ranch.
Wow.
In a room with George Lucas. And it was just about, he was just researching the prequels for the Star Wars.
Okay.
This is 95, cool. I think. And what was great about that is I'm sitting in the room, we're beating out a story. He took a yellow legal pad and put each character's name at the top.
Okay.
And then 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Three beats in three different acts.
Okay.
And we would just spend the time doing one line for each little number that was there. That's how he did American Graffiti.
Wow.
And that's how we were going to do this thing. And what was interesting about working with George Lucas was, once you got in a room and you're working on a writing thing, he was just like any other writer. It was like, oh my God, we got to do this piece of show.
Right.
You
know, that's funny. Yeah,
he's bitching and moaning. I say, hey, how's the new Star Wars going? Oh my God, I got to do this. You know, just the typical, you know, this guy's a multi-billionaire.
Yeah, oh God.
I got to write this. You know, he was just like the rest of us. So I did that. And then I got a job on a show called The Home Court. I think I was the last person hired in Hollywood. It was late June, and it was a show starring Pamela Reed. And I know I was the last person hired in Hollywood, because the people had been there for 2 weeks already, the other writers.
Okay,
see. And I guess they must have got something in their budget to get another writer.
Okay.
And, you know, I latched onto the show, and it was on NBC. It only lasted about 20 episodes, but it was now a credit. And the next spring, my agent says, go watch this tape, and then I want you to interview with this guy, Phil Rosenthal. And I watched the tape, and it's a show. I didn't know anything about it. It's a show that features Ray Romano, who was a guy that I came up with in New York. So I knew Ray. We'd played golf, and we played softball together. And Ray's, boy, he's a pretty good actor. And there's this one scene in there that's really funny, which is the scene about the Fruit of the Month Club, where Ray tries to give his mother the Fruit of the Month Club, and parents freak out over this. And it was based on a true thing that happened with Phil and his parents.
Okay.
And I meet with Phil after watching the video, and I guess he had seen some of my spec scripts.
Okay.
And I got a job offer. But at that point, I had also gotten a job offer from the show Coach.
Okay.
Which was going to be in its final season.
Okay.
And they were guaranteed 22 episodes. This Raymond show, unknown comedian nobody knew of.
Right, right.
13.
Okay.
So I remember one of my agents saying, go with Coach. That's the sure thing.
Right.
It's 22 episodes. Nobody knows if this Raymond thing's going to last. And I just decided I want to go with the Raymond thing because I had heard good things about Phil from Mike Rowe.
Okay.
And I didn't want to be on a show like Coach where they'd already done all the stories.
Right. It's like the final swan song. It's like you really can't – everything's been done. This is – the grounds are wide open.
Exactly. So I took that leap, and it was the best decision I ever made because 9 years later – two Emmy Awards. And
yeah, I saw you won two Emmys. Now, yeah. Now that was the writing staff won two Emmys.
The writing staff won
and
two
now,
Emmys. Yeah.
Now, so you were on the show from day one. Basically.
From day one, yeah, except for the pilot, yeah.
And then just so now I know you eventually you were the executive producer or?
Well, we all, there was just titles. In TV writing, you know, you have all these different producer titles and it starts with, you know, story editor, then producer, then co-producer.
But you're all in the room.
We're all just writers. And executive producer just means you've made more money than you made when you were supervising producer. And
okay.
They're just kind of titles that indicate a pay grade.
So you wrote, so you went from this Pamela Reed show. So now you're doing Everyone Loves Raymond. Now,
yeah.
Now, what, I mean, was it on hiatus, would you write other projects or anything? Or would you write scripts? Or what? Or would you do stand-up? Or did you just stop doing stand-up completely?
You basically... racking your brains for the next stories.
Okay.
For the next season.
Okay.
Because that's the thing. When you write an episode, that's the writer's sort of horror, is you finish an episode and then you think, at least I did, okay, that's the last idea I'll ever have. That's
okay,
it.
Yeah.
I'm dry.
I can imagine.
You know, I've blown my wad now. That's it. And so you're constantly trying to come up with the next story. So I think that's probably how I spent most of the hiatus.
See, it's great, but then especially, I guess, it makes a difference when first of all, you won an Emmy, and then, you know, it was a very well-written and funny show, so it's like anything. It's not like if you're writing on a crappy show, it's like, if I give something half-assed, you know, people, but
right.
you would constantly, I mean, once you win an Emmy, you have to do better. It's not like you can't sit there and go, we wrote this, and now we're going to write this, you know, so it must have been a lot of pressure.
But we didn't win an Emmy till I think our seventh season.
Okay, but even, I mean,
It was a similar arc to Seinfeld in that nobody knew about Raymond for 4 years.
Okay.
You know, just like Seinfeld, it had to really kind of grow on people. And then after that, it was, and by then we'd kind of hit our stride with,
right.
But what was interesting about that is I had come from Seinfeld a few years before and watched the interaction between Larry and Jerry.
Okay.
And that was a very potent combination, because Larry had a very dark vision of life, and Jerry was Mr. Accessible.
Right.
Like Larry, when at the Improv in New York, we would all watch and Larry on stage because all the comics would, because you want to see when he would implode and storm off the stage because he wasn't getting a laugh or somebody heckled or something. Jerry could be on stage, not get a laugh for an hour, and wouldn't faze him at
all. Okay.
So you had these two people, like Larry's dark vision through Jerry's very accessible prism, common man prism, and it was really a powerful combination together. Ray and Phil, a different dynamic, but a similar, same dynamic, but different characteristics, where Phil really knew story. He really knew how to tell stories.
Okay.
And Ray really had a very unsentimental view of family life.
Okay.
And Ray thought, you know, the show should be about him and his friends sitting around talking. And Phil would say, no, there's got to be a story.
Okay.
And so the combination of Ray's real persona, his real outlook on life, with Phil's skills as a storyteller, and Phil also bringing his own life into it with his parents. For Phil, it was really a story about the parents. And for Ray, it was more of a story. It was about his parents, but it was also about his marriage, too.
Okay.
And it took a long time for trust to develop between them.
I can imagine.
But when it did, it was just such a powerful combination. I was witness to both of those situations where
that's
see two
really
people
cool.
come together.
I mean, that's just, and you said it because it's funny because you compare them it's like the same dynamic but different characteristics, which is, it's just very cool because, basically you were involved with two of the most popular sitcoms around.
Yeah.
So Raymond, they decided to, not doing it anymore, right? You guys just...
Well, we decided as writers, and this was kind of unusual because Phil stayed with the show the whole time.
Okay.
Which, you know, a lot of times somebody gets a hit show and they get a big development deal.
Right.
And Phil did get big development deals, but he ended up giving the money back because he didn't want to leave his baby.
Okay.
And which meant that he retained control of the show, and it meant the writing staff retained control of the show. Because okay. What happens usually when the creator leaves, say on Friends, which, you know, when they left, then the power center becomes the stage, becomes the actors.
Right.
And then the new writers coming in running the show, they don't have the same power because they didn't make those people stars.
Right. Okay.
And so a lot of times you'll have the inmates running the asylum.
Right. Right. Okay. That makes sense.
That never happened with us. That dynamic, you know, stayed the same. So the writers, our room, and about a half a dozen of us were there the whole 9 years. We retained control of the show, and we decided when we wanted to end it.
Okay.
CBS wanted to keep going. The actors wanted to keep going. Ray was really one of us more than, I mean,
right,
he was obviously an actor, but he was in the writer's room as much as he could be and contributed a lot and wrote scripts and really socially kind of identified with us more than he did with the other actors. And we decided, we had big boards with all the scripts, you know, and it ended up, you know, being 210 all told.
Okay.
We didn't want to repeat ourselves.
Okay.
And Phil had, you know, Phil had never seen a show. He'd said, I never saw a show that was better after 7 years. And so even going more than 7 years was a stretch for him. And the final year, we said, this is going to be the final year. What we're going to do is we're going to have a little brainstorming session, and we'll see how many stories we come up with, and then we'll double it, and we'll tell CBS that's how many we're doing. So we sat around. We came up with 8 different story premises in about an hour.
Okay.
And Phil said, okay, we're going to do 16 shows for the last season.
Now, it's usually 22 episodes, right?
Yeah, 20. We were doing sometimes 24, 26.
So you just said 16, and that's it?
Yes.
So now CBS must have been bummed because it was a hit.
They fought it. But we knew not only was that happening, you know, we didn't want to repeat ourselves. We didn't want, you know, we were kind of running concurrently with Friends, and every other year they'd say, Friends has had a great comeback year. And to have a great comeback year, that means you had to have a shitty year before
right,
that.
Right, exactly. It's like the Domino's pizza. Like, oh, try our pizza. The crust is great. That means it sucked for all this
year.
That's
years. Right.
It's like, come on.
So we're trying not to have the shitty year. And some of the older actors, like Peter Boyle, we didn't realize how sick he was okay. at the time. You know, they're having trouble. He was having trouble with lines and physical. He'd had a heart attack during the course of the show. He'd had a stroke before that.
Right.
He was not in good shape. And actually, if we'd gone the other 2 years that the network wanted us to do, he wouldn't have lasted, and we
right.
would have had to do the Frank funeral show. And we didn't want that.
Yeah, you don't want to do that crime. That's like so depressing.
Yeah.
So it was. I mean, was it? I mean, we have 3 minutes left.
Sure.
Just, you know, was it? I mean, I guess you guys must have really become like a family, because it's 9 years, and it's like, as I, you know, it's like anything. You guys are comedic.
It's high school, college, and a year of graduate school.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a different. I mean, you came from this infantile stage of a show.
Yeah.
And made it. I mean, was it really hard to leave? I mean, was it sad, or were you relieved that you left with saying we did a great body of work?
It was all of those good things. There was you know, tears, but it was mostly joyous because we were going out on top, and we ended up winning the Emmy the last year, which hardly ever happens.
You won the Emmy
show.
For the best writing or best show that year too, or
best show.
Best show.
Okay. Yeah, we only won one writing Emmy. Tucker Cawley won it a couple years before, but best show, we figured that was the whole package. So that's where my two Emmys come from, is best show.
That's cool. That's great, man.
We ended up on top, and we had kind of a great victory lap at the end, and it was all great. And we still hang out together.
See, that's good. Yes, kept in touch. And because I'm sure, and you all work on different projects. And I wish we could talk more. We have like 2 minutes left. But now you're working on Hot in Cleveland?
No, I'm off Hot in Cleveland, and I'm working on my own. I've got a show pending at, I won't even say it because I don't want to jinx it. But they're trying to do a deal for this other show. And I'm
sitcom?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm just wrote a screenplay and doing a lot of other work related to my documentary that I had done.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to get and see people. Just, you know, it's, what's it called? It's about Ralph Nader.
It's called An Unreasonable Man.
Okay, An Unreasonable Man. Now, you can get that on...
on Amazon, Netflix, DVD.
So I'm going to watch that if it's streaming.
Check it out. And come back. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, because I love – that's one thing. That's the only reason I kept Netflix is because of the documentaries and they stream. And it's a matter of – I mean, I saw – I don't know if you've seen – you're a big – I mean, you made a documentary. Yeah. There's an amazing – not amazing, but really good about the New York Cosmos, the soccer team.
Uh-huh.
Which is just – it's great because I sit there and I just got this new one of these touch gateway screens. So my screen's like 22-inch HD.
Yeah.
So I can actually sit at my desk, which sounds weird, but yeah. And I can watch it instead of like when I'm watching it on my laptop. So anyway, Steve, I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Coop.
And you guys, listen, come out this Friday to Flappers 11:30 show. I'll be headlining the United Colors of Comedy. That's $5 to get in. Send me an email. I'll get you in free. It's happy hour throughout the show. And listen Friday afternoon, me, John Fogerholm, and we welcomed our new host, Sheldon Anderson. We are doing Living in the Law. We changed the structure a little bit, but we're still talking about law and politics and all fun stuff like that. Send me an email at cooper@925kyhy.com. Add me on Facebook or Twitter. It's @CooperTalk. And look for a new revamped CooperTalk.net. Not revamped. I haven't put it up yet. It'll be coming out in February. So I want to thank you guys. You have a wonderful weekend. Keep listening to Cooper Talk. Thank you again so much, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest star. And don't drink and drive. And be careful this weekend. See you guys next week.